Good afternoon and welcome to the Faculty Lecture Series. It's my pleasure to introduce Richard Eldridge, who will introduce today's speaker. Thank you, Richard.
Gee, thanks, Sarah. So it's my pleasure to introduce my colleague, Alan Baker. Alan is a man of wide acquaintance and accomplishment, both acquaintance at the college. You may know him from playing in the orchestra with him, where he is a mainstay of the violin section. You may know him from the chess club, where he's the founding member and presiding spirit of the shogi section of the chess club, or it's an independent shogi. Yes. He's also been, for faculty members, widely involved in discussion groups here at the college of various kinds. He's organizing, together with Mark Goodwin, a tri-college group in the philosophy of mathematics for next year. And since his time here, he's been a regular participant in the Tri-College Discussion Group on Complexity, Emergence, and Chaos Theory. To give you the backstory to all this, Alan took his undergraduate degree at Cambridge University. Following that, he went directly to Ghana to teach logic for 1 year, 2 years?
One year.
Then came back to philosophy and entered the PhD program at Princeton, where he completed his PhD. In the philosophy of mathematics, principally writing on the indispensability argument for the existence of mathematical objects. He moved to Xavier University for 3 years, and then we brilliantly stole him from there to come here. Last year, he held a Fulbright Fellowship at the University of what?
In Tartu, in Estonia.
Tartu, in Estonia? In Estonia, from where he traveled to meet people all over the Baltic states. He now has an international acquaintanceship in philosophy of mathematics circles with colleagues ranging from Australia to Estonia to Brazil and elsewhere. His work has centered in both general philosophy of science and in the philosophy of mathematics, particularly with arguments about the existence of mathematical objects, with collateral interests also in modern philosophy. The interesting work we're hearing today brings together work in general philosophy of science and in mathematics. It's on, as you can see from the title, what sort of a science something called experimental mathematics might be. Alan Baker.
Well, thanks very much. I'm going to start with this picture, because it's November the 5th, and tonight is bonfire night in England, so as I speak, my compatriots are setting off fireworks and burning effigies of the 17th century ringleader of a plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament, Guy Fawkes, pictured in the middle of the bonfire there. But I also cleverly am segueing into my first quote of the evening. Now, this is a famous to philosophers quote, an infamous quote maybe, the 18th century philosopher David Hume, and it's going to introduce the main theme of my talk today. Hume was worried about what kinds of disciplines, what kinds of methods lead to knowledge or have content. He was particularly worried about here divinity and metaphysics. I'm not going to worry too much about divinity today. I'm going to worry about metaphysics. His worry really is whether there's any space between abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number on the one hand, or experimental reasoning on the other. In other words, if something isn't abstract and numerical and it's not experimental, is it doing any work for you at all? And if not, we should just consign it to the flames. So the terminology I'm going to use is going to be slightly different. Today, rather than abstract reasoning and experimental reasoning, we have two other pieces of philosophical terminology that I want to introduce. Confusingly, they sound fairly similar, so I might write them up on the board at some point and leave them there. What Hume is calling experimental reasoning, I'm going to use the term a posteriori. A posteriori knowledge or an a posteriori claim is something that you can only know on the basis of experience. So it's not true that it rained earlier today, I think. But in order to know it's not true, I needed to do more than just think about it really hard. I had to have a certain set of experiences, or at least be informed by experience. So the claim that it rained earlier today would be an example of an a posteriori proposition. Notice it's going to be important for later on that the only here knowable only on the basis of experience. It's going to turn out that that's going to be important. Then the other side of the dichotomy here is a priori. This means that we don't need experience. A claim is a priori if we can know it just by pure thought of some sort. So the claim either it rained earlier today or it didn't, if I happen not to have been outside or not really had any relevant experiences, the idea is that I ought still to be able to conclude that that is true. Okay, so that would be an a priori proposition. Okay, so that's going to correspond roughly to Hume's experimental reasoning and abstract reasoning. Now, the traditional view is that if we're going to make a rough distinction here, that mathematics is a priori. So if we take a mathematical claim, like there's a prime number between 5 and 10, that we do indeed know this is true, but that this knowledge is not based on any particular experience, and this therefore should be classified as a priori. I'll come in a few minutes just to, if we can worry about this, but we'll start with this, the traditional view. And then that's going to contrast with empirical science, including physics. You can have sentences that are superficially of the same form. There is a planet between Mars and Saturn, say. And again, in order to know whether that's true or not, we need to have made some observations, done some experiments, had some experiences. So the question I want to ask then is how firm, or how fixed is this division between a priori mathematics and a posteriori science? Okay. Is there any sense in which the boundary could be blurred or even reversed? In other words, are there cases falling on the mathematical side where we're going to want to say that the reasoning is based on experience, is a posteriori, and conversely, the reasoning on the scientific side that we're going to want to classify as a priori? Okay. And I'm putting this in terms of experimental mathematics, right? Mathematics based on observation or experiment, and what I'm calling armchair physics, so we can generalize it to armchair science in general. And these two questions are going to form the central part of my talk, and then towards the end I'm going to talk a little bit about metaphysics and where that might fit into the picture. Now, one consequence of the definition of a priori knowledge and a posteriori knowledge is there's nothing to stop a particular person knowing an a priori proposition through experience, okay? Because a posteriori, let's write this up here. So a proposition is a posteriori if it's only knowable through experience. All right? Which leaves open things that I might happen to know by experience, but aren't. I don't have to know them that way. So what am I talking about here? Well, in the mathematical case, there are plenty of, you know, I'm not a particularly sophisticated mathematician, but there's plenty of things that I think I know mathematically that I don't think I have an a priori justification for. All right? So let me give you a well-known example. I think that Fermat's last theorem is a theorem. I think it's most likely true, and I think I know it. I think I have good reasons for thinking it's true. Can I prove it? No. Do I have even the vaguest idea? Maybe the vaguest idea, but not much more than that. Very few people can prove it, right? Maybe a handful, if that. But I don't want to say that Fermat's last theorem is therefore not an a priori proposition. I think what I want to say here is that I have a posteriori access to it, or a posteriori knowledge of it. How is it a posteriori? Well, I've read newspaper reports, I've talked to mathematical experts, and I've got information, I've had experiences that lead me to think that someone else has proved this, right? So I'm at the end of a chain that started off maybe with an a priori proof, but I'm at the end of a long a posteriori chain. So it seems like one way of putting this would be that Fermat's last theorem is a priori for the mathematical community, but not necessarily a priori for every member of that community, right? As long as someone in the community has proved it. But actually, it gets even, we might want to relax the notion of a priori even more. Because there are other examples where we might want to say that the community, the mathematical community, has a priori knowledge, right? Has a proof, where no individual member actually can or has proved it. The one example that's relatively well known to mathematicians is the classification of the finite simple groups. It doesn't matter what a finite simple group is for this purpose. What matters is that the classification of all of them, which was completed in the mid-80s, ran to 500 journal articles, about 10,000 pages of mathematics, and about 100 different authors contributing to it over a 30-year period. So this is sometimes called the enormous theorem, for good reasons. Okay, so we might want to say, look, the mathematical community has proved the enormous theorem. And it may turn out that you can make it a bit less enormous, but let's talk about when they first proved it. And in that case, no single mathematician could prove it. It's too big. Right? So that would be a sense of the community having a priori knowledge of this thing, where actually no single person had that knowledge. And I think there's more interesting things to say here, but I want to move on and take away from this a point that's going to come back on the other side of the divide when we talk about the armchair physics, which is that one way of thinking of this is that my cognitive limitations, or the cognitive limitations of individual human mathematicians, is what leads to the reliance on a posteriori methods here. Okay? When I'm not smart enough to prove something, I rely on someone who is, right, roughly. And when the community as a whole isn't smart enough individually, they can sometimes, as a community, prove the thing, and sometimes they won't even be able to do that. But the idea here is that somehow cognitive limitations are placing limitations on an individual or a community's a priori access to something. Okay? That sometimes, because your pure reasoning powers are not good enough, you may end up with a posteriori knowledge of an a priori proposition. Okay, what about on the other side of the divide? I'm going to get to the physics case in a few minutes, but you might think that a similar thing goes on with some of our knowledge about the world, about the physical world. So, I think the world is round. I think the world's a sphere. I don't think I've ever really had an experience that has persuaded me of that. I certainly haven't ever seen it directly as spherical. I think my experience is fairly consistent with it being flat, actually. I think I can certainly organize my experience in a way that makes sense of it being flat. And of course, that's why, for a long time, most people thought it was flat. Why do I think it's spherical? Again, it's probably because experts on these things have told me it, and I've also seen images like this one. Of course, this is not observing the world to be spherical. This is an image. It could be a big conspiracy. But I'm not introducing this to be skeptical about it, just to say that in a sense, what I have here is probably indirect a posteriori knowledge, in a sense. Right? I haven't made direct observation of the fact. But it's not parallel with the mathematical case, because here I'm still in the realm of the a posteriori. I'm just moving from sort of direct to indirect. And maybe that's not a distinction we want to work with here, but there's not a sense here that because I haven't seen it myself, I have to rely on a priori methods. But what we're going to see later on is that may sometimes happen. Okay, so there may be a sort of a mirror image case here in the empirical sense. It's important not to confuse the a priori, a posteriori distinction with whether something is actually relevant to the real world. Okay? So, in other words, we could argue that mathematics is a priori and also maintain it's very useful in predicting experience and telling us about the world. And one picture here is this sort of one. So on the left-hand side, the M1, M2 would be some sort of mathematical theory, set of mathematical claims, and this is some physical situation. So say I'm swinging a pendulum and I want to know where it's going to be in 3 seconds' time. I could just wait and see, right? Or I could model it mathematically and make a mathematical prediction and then map it back onto the physical situation. And if my model is a good one and I've preserved the relevant things, that may give me a way of predicting something about the physics. But that says nothing about the a prioricity, and that's the adjective, I think, of the mathematical case. I mean, take a simple example. 17 is prime. Okay, so if I have 17 pieces of I was going to say cake, but we can slice those up, 17 pieces of wrapped up pieces of Halloween candy, and a certain number of small children I need to divide them among, right? Knowing that 17 is prime will tell me something about how I can or can't divide these things. For example, if there's more than one child, I can't give them equal numbers of candy without having some left over. Does that mean 17 is prime, it's not a priori? No. I mean, it's perfectly well could be a priori, it's just a useful thing to know in this candy dividing situation, okay? So again, I mean, we could have numerical facts about number theory and facts about candy, and if they map onto each other in a relevant way, then the a priori facts can be useful. Whether that's a mysterious thing that needs explaining is a subject for another talk. I'm not going to say anything more about applied mathematics here, but just to say that I want to separate out those two issues. Well, let's get on to the question here about what applied mathematics might look like, and I'm going to go through, I'm not going to talk about bubbles yet. I'm going to talk about Gauss. I'm going to take two approaches here. One is to actually look at some possible examples of experiments that maybe might have been done or could be done or are being done for mathematical reasons. Okay, so that's one way in to try and get a handle on experimental mathematics. Other examples of experiments with mathematical payoffs, if you like. And then the second approach will be to look at areas of mathematics that sound like they really should be a posteriori. But let's take the first approach first. There's a story which I think is probably actually apocryphal of Gauss, famous, I mean, you know he's famous because he's on money. he went up one German mountain and triangulated, I guess, with light rays to two other German mountains to make a big triangle, and they weren't that close together. And the story is, look, he measured the angles inside this triangle and saw if they added up to 180 degrees or not. In other words, he was working out whether we really are in a Euclidean universe, right? Because Euclidean geometry predicts the interior angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. It turns out that's probably not what he was doing. And that anyway, the experiment error is a way to, I mean, any curvature that you could measure here would be way too small. But imagine someone did this, right? You could do it with stars as well. I mean, you could do it with things that are much further away from each other than you'd actually have a hope of measuring this. And of course, it turns out that space isn't Euclidean. But the point for these purposes is that whatever you find out here, let's go back to this thing, is not about the truth of Euclidean geometry. It's about whether it's applicable to the world, right? What it's telling you is Euclidean geometry a good model for physical space? If your triangles in physical space don't add up to 180 degrees, it's probably not. If they do, it might well be. But it's not as if the payoff here was purely mathematical, right? Whatever he was doing here, you're not going to say, and therefore Euclidean geometry as a pure theory in itself is false. Okay, so I want to argue that, I mean, irrelevant whether he actually did this and what he was trying to do, that wouldn't count as a mathematical experiment because you're not really testing a mathematical theory. What you're testing is the applicability of a mathematical theory. Second example, Buffon's needle. Some of you may have come across this one. This is where I launch off into hyperspace. Okay, let's see. Turns out you can approximate pi by dropping needles or similar shaped things on top of a grid, or not a grid, whatever you call this thing, with two parallel lines, and counting the number of times that a needle crosses at least one line. Okay, so you imagine a piece of paper with two lines on it, or set of lines, dropping pins. How does pi get involved? Well, intuitively, your chance of crossing a horizontal line depends on the orientation of the needle, and that's got to do with a circle, how it's orientated. I'm certainly not going to go through the mathematics here, but it turns out you can get a formula for the probability of it crossing a line that's based on pi, and therefore by doing the experiment enough times, I'll do it 10 times. Down here is the approximation we're getting for pi. It's not terribly good yet. No, it's in the ballpark. It's getting worse. And it's getting better. So, I mean, it's not, you know, that's 1,000 needle drops, 3.11 roughly. If you carried on, you'd get better, right? Is this a mathematical experiment? The problem here, I think, is, aside from the statistical nature of the result, is that you're not learning anything new. And you're certainly not learning anything that you couldn't prove just through a priori methods. Okay, we have a priori methods, traditional proof methods of getting pi to whatever degree of accuracy we want. Okay, so we don't need to drop needles. We're not discovering a new mathematical result here. Okay, so again, I want to argue that that's not really not really experimental mathematics in any full-fledged sense. I think the closest example is this next one, which is a little grainy. In the 19th century, there were mathematicians interested in this problem of minimal surfaces. So given some set of points in space or some structure, what's the minimum surface area that's needed to bound it? Okay. And there was a blind Belgian physicist called Plateau who hit on the idea of, well, he's not the first to hit on the idea of using bubbles, but in this particular case of using soap films. Turns out that soap likes to adopt a configuration of minimum to minimize the energy of the surface, which corresponds to minimizing the surface area, which is why bubbles are spherical, for example. But when you dip these things suitably into soap, you actually get the minimal surfaces, if you're careful. Okay, and they often turn out to be kind of weird and surprising. So this is actually an inside cube with faces going out to the edge. So this is the case for the cube. This method was used to discover, as you might put it, to discover answers to some of these minimal surface problems. Okay, so isn't this a mathematical experiment? This, I think, is the closest that we have so far. We are getting discovery. We're generally discovering new mathematical results. And we're doing it here by reversing the order of the traditional thing. So what I had up on the board before was this mathematical physics link, where you use the mathematics to get the physics. Here we're using the physics to learn something about mathematics. So we're saying, there's the relationship between bubbles and minimal surfaces. Do your bubble thing, or your soap film thing, and then you can make a prediction about the minimal surface, okay? Which is kind of reversing the normal use of applied mathematics. The reason I think it's not going to count as full-fledged experimental mathematics is now on the justification side. It is actually quite easy once you have a minimal surface to prove that it's minimal. I mean, I say easy, relatively easy. For these people, it was easy. Their problem was to actually work out what the surface was in the first place. So, having discovered this, you could go away and prove it. So in a sense, your justification at the end of the day, you could still argue was a priori. It was just based on proof. Okay. So tentative conclusion from these sorts of literal experiments is that none of them capture... Well, we have the sort of Fermat's Last Theorem case where cognitive limitations lead to reliance on maybe a posteriori methods. In that case, I'm not learning anything new to the community as a whole. In the case of the Buffon's needle kind of case, we're perhaps getting a new way of justifying a known result. So a new way of justifying the rough value of pi. Okay, but it's not a new result. Here we're actually getting a new result, but we can still stay with an a priori justification. So no single example is really capturing all aspects of mathematical method here. And also these cases are rare. I've more or less given you, maybe a couple of others, but that's about it for literal experiments or anything that approximates a literal experiment. So it's certainly not central to mathematical method, these examples. So I want to move on to a second approach, which is a sort of hermeneutic approach. Look for things in mathematics that sound experimental. So mathematicians have labs, which is... I want to have a philosophy lab one day, so I like labs. They also do stuff that they call experimental mathematics. In fact, it's a growing field. Surely experimental mathematics is experimental, right, you might think. Well, if you notice what was in the labs, it was computers, I guess, kind of strange-looking computers. But and it turns out that if you open your experimental mathematics book, it's all about computers and computer programs and what people have done with their programs. What's the link here, then, between computers and experimentation? Let's a couple of examples. Here's another famous still conjecture, because it hasn't been proved. 500 years old now? So no, 400 years old probably. Goldbach's conjecture. Another frustratingly simple to state and has resisted attempts at proof. Every even number other than 2 can be expressed as the sum of 2 primes. Mathematicians think it's true. You can verify it for as long as you feel like it. When you get tired, you can turn it over to a computer, which is currently being done. As of April of this year, they verified it all the way up to 10 to the 18. So they checked every even number from 4 to this number, and every time you can find 2 prime numbers. Okay? So that's a lot of numbers, but there's a lot left, right? So this is not a project with a future in terms of proof, right? This is not, you know, this is long-term in the extreme. But nonetheless, it seems like it's evidence, right? I mean, once you've done 10 to the 18 of these things, I think you're pretty sure it's true. So there's a sense in which the computer is providing evidence. Nearly all of these cases, I mean, human beings have done a few thousand cases, maybe up to 10,000. The rest have been done by computer. So nearly all the cases here have been done by computer in a way that we couldn't really turn over to human labor here. So we have here, in a sense, computer evidence. You know, in some sense, computer evidence for a mathematical conjecture. And it's not just restricted to evidence. Computers have proved things, or at least computers have been involved in the proof. The famous example here is the four-color theorem. This, again, for a long time was a conjecture. It was proved in 1976, I think. Question is, what is the fewest number of colors to color a map on the plane such that no two regions that share a common border are colored the same way? And it was long conjectured that you didn't need more than 4 colors. It turns out it doesn't actually help you, ironically, to color real maps, because you have to keep the seas all the same color. You know, the different seas are all blue, so actually you need more than 4 colors, in theory, for a real map. But it's still an interesting mathematical problem. And also the other problem is that countries sometimes have bits that are off them, so like Russia and Kaliningrad are the same country. You want them to be the same color, but they're actually 2 different regions. Yes, and that's pretty discontinuous as well. This was proved in 1976 using a big part of the proof was just going through a lot of different cases. They reduced it to something like 1,600 different cases of various degrees of complexity. And it basically said, look, if we can show that all these work, then the theorem's proved. So that was the proof reduced it to this thing. That stuff was done on a computer, several hundred hours of computer work, albeit 1976 computer work, in a way that didn't seem replaceable, again, by human mathematical effort. So we have computers here involved in the justification of interesting and important problems, sometimes even involved in the proof of those problems. But again, why think it's experimental? It's a good question, because when you open up these experimental mathematics books, there's usually a chapter at the beginning where they talk about why it's experimental, but it's all fairly metaphorical. Here's a typical sort of quote: computing is to mathematics as the telescope is to astronomy. Probably it should be the computer is to mathematics. Anyway, it might not explain things, but it certainly shows what's out there. Okay? So this idea of computer as means of access to the mathematical realm, computer as instruments. So there is certainly an analogy. I showed you a math lab. It's full of computers. A science lab will be full of other sorts of equipment, maybe including computers, but microscopes and such things. So there's certainly an idea. Look, you know, these are the machines that mathematicians use to augment their abilities, in a sense. And another sense in which it's experimental, I guess, sort of derivatively, is that the way we build computers and program them certainly depends on a posteriori knowledge, right? They're physical things, and they depend on a knowledge of physics to actually be built. And then, as the quote I just gave you suggests, there's a sense in which the results are not explanatory. They're raw data coming out in the same way there's something coming out of an instrument. So that's the reason to think you could consider it experimental. The problem is, there are other reasons for thinking not. I mean, this metaphor of seeing, I think it has to be metaphorical, right? When I see the water bottle in front of me, there's a sense in which that's because of the causal activity of the water bottle on me, right? Whatever's happening when a mathematician sits in front of a computer and runs some piece of software, there's not going to be a causal interaction with the numbers involved, right? Whatever the objects are of mathematics, it's not as if we're literally trying to causally interact with the mathematical realm. The other thing is, you know, what are we doing when we program computers? We're really trying to mimic certain aspects of human thought. So you might think that you know, these are really sort of extensions of our a priori capabilities. So the kinds of things that computers are doing are really just pushing, you know, faster and more efficiently things that we're doing when we reason a priori. And then related to that, that given enough time and enough patience and enough people, you could in principle reproduce this, right? 10 to the 18, it's big, but it's, well, maybe it is too big, but, you know, given enough people and enough time, it's not too big. You could do that, right? So there's a sort of, in practice, in principle distinction, right? So I'm going to, a tentative conclusion, I'm going to come down on the no side to whether computers are experimental, at least in the sense of giving us a posteriori knowledge. Okay? I'm going to argue, at least provisionally, that computer mathematics is not experimental in any sense that should force us to see the results as a posteriori. But nonetheless, the boundary is being blurred here, and it's being blurred because of cognitive limitations. Okay, what's been going on is our cognitive abilities are being augmented by the computer. All right, so I want to come at this now from the second direction, which is from the direction of armchair physics, possibly. Yeah, here we go. So the connotation of armchair here, I'm using it slightly, I don't know how I'm using it, ironically. What I mean by armchair physics or armchair science is that no attempt, you're doing armchair physics if you're not attempting to make the appropriate kinds of observations or causally interact with the objects that you're studying. So it's to take off from this idea of seeing. I think in order to be respectable, we need a Greek word for it. Unfortunately, the Greeks didn't have armchairs, as far as I can tell. They had they had couches, like reclining couches, and they had stools. But if you put together arm and diphros is the sort of standard Greek chair with a back, so brachiodiphrology. I mean, technically, it's the study of armchairs, but it's going it will serve my purposes. Look, the point about sitting in an armchair is not that you have no experiences, but you just maybe have no relevant experiences. So if you're doing armchair ornithology, unless you happen to be having your armchair in the middle of a jungle or something, you're not making the appropriate kinds of observations. I did come across the armchair nanotube. But with the exception of that, there's not much you can interestingly, you know, the armchair connotation is meant to be, again, not having no experiences, but having no relevant experiences. Can you find out how the world is, you know, the physical world is, through a priori reasoning, through just thinking hard enough? A couple of quick points about how you can. You can work out what follows from what, from your armchair. So, for example, that a certain scientific law implies another scientific law, or this is a special case of that, or there'll be things about the logical relations between scientific hypotheses that you can work out from the armchair. Of course, you will only be interested probably in those hypotheses because of experiment, but the actual reasoning could be purely armchair reasoning. You could infer the properties of a hypothetical entity or an entity about which whose existence you didn't care or didn't know about. But again, that would be informed by information about the entity that you would have probably from experimental reasoning. And you can also do thought experiments. I'm not going to talk about thought experiments here, but that's a class of perhaps armchair reasoning. Again, the problem is going to be that the principles by which you evaluate the thought experiment are probably going to come from experience. So take, you know, Newton's thought experiment about firing a cannonball further and further in a sort of diagonal direction. It falls further and further away, and as you fire it far enough, it starts orbiting right around the world. Right, and this idea of orbit as the extension of a cannonball firing. But why we think the cannonball would do that is based on experience. Okay. So those sorts of examples are not telling us really how the world is. They're telling us about deductive links between things. They're telling us about the hypothetical properties of things, were they to exist. And they're telling us about what's possible and impossible, maybe in the case of thought experiments. But how about knowledge about how things are? Can we get that from the armchair? Well, the example I want to consider is scientific theories which go beyond any available or even in principle available means of observation. And the canonical example here, this came out backwards. Oh, no, it's meant to be backwards. string theory. There's been quite a lot of press, I mean, the popular science press about string theory. also called superstring theory, one of the theories at the boundaries of current physics. Why is string theory so controversial? Well, it's apparently because the leading string theories disagree only about things that are so remote from possible experiment that it looks like it's going to be impossible to actually experimentally distinguish between them. So very roughly speaking, there's an 11-dimensional version of string theory and a 26-dimensional version of string theory, where the dimensions are rolled up really, really tiny, the ones you can't see beyond the three that we can see, or four. But they seem to be so small that you would require such high energies to see them that we could never actually experimentally distinguish. This is the argument. So say this is true. It turns out to be a little bit more complicated than this. But say we had two theories, 11-dimensional and 26-dimensional. The argument is, in this case, we're not doing science anymore. Okay? We've got two theories where no possible experiment's going to distinguish between them. And so commentators have argued, I mean, often physicists actually, have argued that we're not, once we go beyond experiment, we're back either in the realm of pure mathematics or maybe in metaphysics. But whatever we're not doing science in the traditional sense. And how worried we should be about that depends on your commentator. I'm not going to talk about the string theory case, because what I want to argue is that actually in much more mundane cases you get the same kind of problem. We don't need to go all the way out to these esoteric theories. That we get the same thing going on more or less whenever we do scientific reasoning. And the problem is, well, two problems. One is the experimental data we have never conclusively implies what the right hypothesis is. Okay, so you're doing some experiment, and you get some nice points, and you're lucky they're all lying on a nice line. You know, it's a couple of things related to each other. And you're trying to decide what the actual relationship is between these things. So you think, well, that's nice, they're all on a line. So that must be the right relationship. But notice, there's a sense in which that I didn't have to draw the line that way. You might say, well, look, I did. It had to go through all the points, right? But, you know, this, well, except I can't draw it properly, but this is going, I'll move my point. That goes through all the points as well, right? Why isn't that an equally good candidate for the relationship between these two things, right? And, of course, I can draw infinitely many other bizarre-shaped curves. So one way of putting this is that the available evidence here underdetermines, doesn't determine what the right curve to draw here is. And you might say, well, that's not too bad because I can always do some more experiments. So now I want to decide between these two. I can look at something else, and if I get this, then I know my straight line was right and my curve was wrong. But nonetheless, at any point where you stop observing and make a hypothesis, there's going to be an infinite number of different ways of drawing a curve. So what do we do in these situations? We tend to want to do... the other thing is the situation is nearly always worse than this because we don't have things lying on a line, right? We have experimental error and we have things, you know, maybe not too far from being on a line, but they're, you know, this sort of thing. And we're sort of drawing some sort of line between them, right? What are we trying to do here? We're trying to fit, get as close to as many of these points as possible. We're also trying to be as simple as possible. Now, we're not always just going to have a straight line, so if we get something like this, yeah, we're probably going to draw this. But there's going to be a balance here between how complicated your curve is and how many points you go through. But the point I want to make is that however you're deciding how to draw these curves, on how to prefer one curve over another, that's not on the basis of the experimental evidence, right? It's not the experimental evidence that tells you this is better than this, right? And if it's not the experimental evidence that's doing, then what is doing it? What seems to be going on is that we have certain sort of, we have preferences as part of the scientific methodology for simpler, mathematically simpler relationships in these sorts of cases, and that we use those in hypothesizing from the data. But that happens, as I say, that we don't need to go to string theory to see that. That will happen any time we make a scientific hypothesis on the basis of data. And we can make things worse, okay? If we are allowed to cook up any old theories we want. We can create theories that are empirically equivalent. In other words, two theories that really just say all the same things. These are not equivalent, right? They make different predictions. Bertrand Russell has an example a bit like this one. We dig up a bunch of fossils and we're trying to work out what the best theory is for why these fossils are there. And we have H1, that dinosaurs roamed the Earth millions of years ago, died and were fossilized. And then we have H2, which is the world was created 500 years ago or 5 minutes ago, it doesn't matter, by an ironic deity who included rocks shaped like the bones of large reptiles. And the idea is these can be tailored to make all the same predictions about fossils. Right. So however we should prefer H1 to H2, and we think we're rational in so doing, but that's not because of any experimental difference between their predictions about fossils. Or we can add things onto our theories. All right? So if I said, look, which is more likely to be true? I mean, you may not like quantum mechanics, but which is more likely to be true, H3 or H4? And you say, oh, H3. And whatever you're doing, you're not doing it because H3 makes better predictions, because H4 makes exactly the same predictions. Okay? This, of course, is not an invisible pixie, but this is what an invisible pixie would look like if it were visible. We have another principle here, maybe, which is, if you can do it with fewer things, don't add things. In other words, don't add things to your theories that aren't doing any work. But hey, the world could have invisible pixies in it, right? Who's to say there aren't invisible pixies on every subatomic particle? Okay? We think there aren't, but again, it's not from having done a whole bunch of experiments, right? We don't have any pixie-eliminating experiment, right? Well, however we're eliminating pixies, it's through these sorts of general principles about maybe they're not doing any useful theoretical work, right? Some philosopher said, we act as if there's no social security in the physical world. If something's not paying its way, then we don't assume it, right? Maybe that's true of invisible pixies. All right, so this leads to the final few minutes of the talk, where I want to suggest that one thing we can do with this is argue that while there may be no purely armchair science, in other words, reasoning about how the world is that proceeds from start to finish in the armchair, as it were, that there's a sense in which there's an armchair component whenever we make substantive claims about the world. And the armchair component is the reliance on these principles that seem not to be derived from or based on experience. They're principles that we use to actually organize and systematize and generalize from our experience. Okay. So what happens if we take these components? So we have like experimental evidence plus these principles of theory choice, okay, which I'm arguing are non-empirical. What happens if we take away the experimental evidence? I mean, do we just take away the experimental stuff and we're just left with the principles, okay? One suggestion is, in so doing, we can actually then move from physics or science in general to metaphysics. That we can make room for metaphysics that really is completely disconnected from experiment, but just sort of takes over these general theory principles. So I just want to talk for a couple of minutes about metaphysics, since this is one of the things that Hume was worried about. Now, metaphysics is a dangerous term. It doesn't... if you go into Borders and look in the metaphysics section, you have books on aura photography and astrological charts and crystals and all this sort of stuff. Maybe that's metaphysics, but it's not metaphysics in the sense that I'm interested in today. In particular, it's not constrained by anything at all, really. I mean, these are speculations that, some of them could be true, but they're not really constrained. And this notion of constraint also goes over to something else that gets called metaphysics, which is sort of the speculations of scientists about stuff, usually by famous scientists, about stuff that they aren't actually famous for doing. So Penrose on, and again, I'm not to say this is valueless or wrong, but it is relatively unconstrained. Penrose on consciousness, Hawking on God. A lesser known example is Eddington. This is the largest specific number ever to figure in a claim about the world. So Eddington's a famous physicist. In 1923, he decided he could work out how many protons there were in the universe through a priori means. So he was doing metaphysics, basically, here. He based it on the value of the fine structure constant, which he thought was 1 over 136. Unfortunately, it turned out to be closer to 1 over 137. And he then redid his proof and managed to prove the same thing from that. So that's what I mean by lack of constraint. I mean, in a sense, it was kind of impressive, but it was not too constrained by the actual evidence here. But this is bad metaphysics. Is there room for good metaphysics? Well, what I'm suggesting is, you know, the Cheshire Cat's grin, that we can take over these theoretical virtues that I want to argue scientists are using anyway, and they're not using on the basis of experiment, they're using to organize their experimental evidence. This is not a definitive list. We can argue with these as well, and there's probably more, but elegance would be the simplicity of the, you know, the mathematical simplicity. Parsimony would be not having sprites all over the place. Fruitfulness, how does it lead to developing more theories, more powerful theories, interesting other theories, explanatory power, etc., etc. Consistency would be another one. We don't want to have inconsistent theories. Could we do metaphysics to decide between theories that have no real experimental implications at all? In other words, here's my metaphysical theory, here's your metaphysical theory, we'll just look at this stuff. Okay, I'll give you a quick case study. I'm running out of time, but mereology is the metaphysics of parts and wholes. Philosophers argue, so this is not Eddington's worry, this is not how many things there are in the universe, this is like how many things there are in your shopping cart when you check out the supermarket. So when we have some things, we can also have, you know, things made up of things. This table is a thing, but it also has it has legs, kind of, wheels. When do some things make up a thing? When is a thing? When are a bunch of things a thing? Okay, that sounds like metaphysics, right? Allism is the view that every collection of things is a thing. So that table-like thing is a thing because it's made up of things, right? that seems okay, but also this bottle and this piece of chalk is a thing. It's a thing whose two parts is this bottle and this piece of chalk. Okay, not only this, but you know. This piece of chalk and the moon is a thing. And this piece of chalk and the moon and the Eiffel Tower is a thing. So anytime you collect, they don't have to be next to each other, anytime you collect things together, you get another thing. So there are lots of things, right? And even if Eddington was right about the number of protons, I mean, you can do the, well, you probably can't do the math, but one could do the math and work out how many, you know, basically you have a set of fundamental particles and then every possible combination of them is going to generate a thing, okay? That's allism. That's the technical name. Nonism is no collection of things is a thing. In other words, whenever something has parts, it's not really a thing. So that's not really a thing, that death. The chair's not really a thing. You're not really a thing. I'm not really a thing. Why not? Because we have parts that are things. So the only things in the world are whatever the fundamental particles are. And whenever you put them together, you don't really have things. We can talk about them. It's convenient fiction, right? We can pretend there are chairs. It's useful to talk as if there are chairs and people and planets. But they're not really there. Okay? Two extreme views, and then, you know, both of which kind of sound kind of insane. Then the attempt to find a middle ground, restricted composition principles. Okay, so not everything collection of things is a thing, but some collections of things are things. So now we need a principle for when a collection of things is a thing. All right, you might come up with some principle. For example, if they're stuck together, they're a thing. So the bits of this table-like thing are a thing because they're stuck together, whereas me and the Eiffel Tower are not a thing because we're not stuck together, right? Now we'd have to get clearer on what stuck together meant. But another view is that the only things there are the fundamental particles and living creatures, organisms. All right? So those are the only real things. So you and I are things, but tables and chairs are not things. Anyway, metaphysics, sort of heavy-duty, hardcore metaphysics. They don't make any experimental predictions. Right? Allism, nonism. Find me an experiment to decide whether this table is a thing or not. Right? You can't do it, right? There's no experiment. These are not disagreeing about experimental evidence. Nonetheless, there's lots of literature being produced by contemporary analytic metaphysicians on which of these is the best thing. And they think, I mean, which of these is right or what the precisely the best principle of composition is, okay? And they don't think they're just, they're constrained. They think of themselves as being constrained, and they think of themselves as being constrained by these kinds of things. Right? Is allism a more explanatory theory? Is it more fruitful? Is it more? It's clearly not more parsimonious, right? Allism, there's a lot more stuff in the world than you thought. But maybe it does better on other things. Maybe it fits better with our intuitions, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is, again, it's the Cheshire Cat's grin, that we can make room for working with these principles of theory choice, even in the absence of any experimental predictions at all. That might make room for some sort of metaphysics. And maybe it would apply in the supermarket. Because if you, on allism, you get to up to 12 things pretty quickly. So say you took out four atomic things in your checkout line. Well, there'd be four things plus this thing plus this thing plus this thing plus this thing. So that's four more. And then four sets of three would be four more. You're already up to 12, right? You've already got 12 things in your cart, right? So there may be actually be applications to the real world. All right, so let me finish up. So I've argued that the boundary between a priori and a posteriori, between mathematics and physics or science in general, can sometimes be blurred by limitations on both sides. So we're cognitively limited creatures. We're not logically omniscient. We can't see the consequences of everything we believe, and certainly not the logical consequences of everything we believe, or the mathematical consequences. And we're also observationally limited. We can't see everything. Right. If we could do both those things, then perhaps there would be a more firm boundary between mathematics and physics. On the mathematical side, we wouldn't need computers or any other form of augmentation, because we could just set down our axioms and we'd know everything that followed from them. We'd know what were theorems and what weren't. And on the observational side, we would never need to fit curves, because we'd have observed all the data. Right? We'd have all the points. It would be solidly... It would already be a curve. But because we are limited in both these ways, there's a need for a priori speculation from what we've actually observed. Okay, so fitting, making predictions beyond that go beyond the evidence. And there's a need, or at least a use, for a posteriori computer-based augmentation of our mathematical knowledge. And in each case, arguably, we have an improvement over guesswork. And in each case, that's partly because of the constraints. That we're in extending our abilities on each side, we are operating under constraints. Okay, and one can wonder about the justification of those constraints. One can wonder, do we get to genuine knowledge? Perhaps we do, perhaps we don't. I mean, that's a big topic. But what I guess what I want to leave you with is the idea that perhaps it's not clear. I mean, in Hume's opening remarks, he says... anything that isn't experimental reasoning or reasoning with abstract quantity is sophistry and illusion. And I want to leave open that some blend, something in the middle here, might at least have the potential for providing objective knowledge about both about mathematics and about the physical world. Okay, thank you very much.